Welcome to Continued Success, a beautiful summer weekend as well. We're actually days away from the actual beginning of summer. Ooh. And we know what that means. It's time for a time of year that certain podcasts have co-opted as their name and become massively popular because of it. Not this one, though. The hell am I talking about? Anyway, it's hitting season. And this is Continued Success with me, Justin Clue. You can follow me on Twitter at Justin_Clue. With me is Liz Rocher of Yahoo Sports. Hello, Liz. You can follow her at Liz Rocher.
Yo.
Good month for the Phillies thus far.
Yeah. I mean, we're just about halfway through it, so anything could happen. But at the moment, we're all feeling good, which is...
Don't do that. Don't do that. Why are you doing? We have to convince people that these podcasts can exist in a non-miserable Phillies situation. We don't need to fuel off them sucking. We can be perfectly normal, fun time podcast because the Phillies are good. This is why we do this, because they were once good and they got us so excited. Don't do that. Don't kick that.
The Phillies are great. I have no bad thoughts.
Kick that teeny door you enter the room in with your foot. Walk through that door and just start throwing your shit everywhere. This is good vibes only town, and I think everybody would agree with me.
Throwing things with my tiny fists through the tiny door.
As we all know, the Phillies have been succeeding of late, winning 12 of 14. They took game one of their game against the National, their series against the Nationals last night, 10-1, a resounding and pretty appropriate win over this Nationals team that just sucks. It includes some key members of the last few Phillies teams that have also sucked. They play them for 5 games, including a doubleheader today. And they should win every one of those games, Liz. I don't really know. You know, I said on hitting season they should win 9 of their next 10. And even to me, that sounds like a lot. And they've already got their one loss under their belt thanks to the bullpen in the Marlins series, which they should have won or they should have swept. But that's, I think that just strengthens my point. Like the one time they've lost in the last 5 games or in the last 4 games is a game they had in hand and was lost because Jairus Familia and Corey Knebel suck and can't get the ball somewhere where the opposing bats either can't find it or don't want to swing at it. So, there's really no reason why this team, playing as well as it has, shouldn't be able to manhandle the Nationals as well as the Braves did.
Completely agree. I feel as if, hopefully by now, Rob Thompson has realized it's a bad idea to put Corey Knebel out there in a high-leverage situation right now. Not a good time. Not a great time at all. So hopefully he'll avoid that going forward.
Well, I was encouraged by the reports that came out after his latest terrible exhibition. First of all, I just keep thinking, like, I wonder how many bad pitches he thinks he's thrown now. Like, that comment really lives in my head back when he was starting to become inconsistent and had given up 2 key home runs to the other team. And he was like, oh, I've just thrown 2 bad pitches. I'm not having a bad month. Well, I'd say he's probably having a bad month now. I think it qualifies now. And I was encouraged that the Phillies came out of that game and they were like, yeah, you know what? We're going to make a change at closer. We're going to close by committee and Knebel's going to get some lower leverage situations until he gets his curveball worked out because that's supposed to be his bread and butter. And I was encouraged by that because it was a direct address of the situation. You know, we're not sitting here till August saying, well, Knebel's the closer. Well, Knebel's the closer. Well, Knebel's the closer. As though, like, he's got this job and he deserves to still have it. I mean, you know, I want him to pitch well. I want him to figure out and become the lights-out closer the Phillies need him to be. But right now, he's not doing that. And I just have it in my head that, like, the Phillies are kind of – it's over 2 months into the season, and they're systematically addressing – the issues at hand. The first one being Joe Girardi. They dismissed him. Worked like a charm. Teams won 12 of 14, or I guess 11 of 13, since because they won their last game with Girardi still managing. And then the next issue seemed to be, hey, the back end of the bullpen is struggling and costing this team some wins. And a couple games later, a couple of Knebel appearances later, they said, hey, we're not going with this anymore. He's got to work this out. We got to just, you know, we're going to have a committee, closer by committee from here on out for a little bit. And I think that's good. I think it's good that it wasn't just like, oh, Knebel's got shoulder soreness. He's going on the IL for a couple of days. No, they were like, yeah, he's not getting the job done. you need somebody in there who can, because I, you know, I've been saying over and over again, I'm not the only one. This team needs to stack up wins no matter how they can. I don't care if they're sloppy. I don't care if they're just because the other team dropped the ball. They need wins, and they got to keep getting wins because the teams around them keep getting wins. So I was very encouraged that they addressed the situation, that they were like, all right, this isn't working, so we're going to do something else. And I hope they keep doing that with each of their individual issues.
Yes, I do. It was a nice surprise to be like, this is not working. Let's try something else. Like, that's not something we've heard a lot, right? In the past few years. It's like, no, we're going to keep, you know, X guy. We're going to keep Brandon Workman as our closer no matter what. No matter how many, you know, grapefruits he throws up there in the late innings. So I was really pleased to hear that. Like, I mean, Knebel can, you know, he'll get it back. Probably.
Maybe.
Maybe.
I mean, like, I don't care. Like,
no,
it's not really the Corey Knebel story. I'm just like, I hope he does, because it would be great to have him, you know, pitch like that. But if he can't, I feel like the Phillies have some good options in the back of the bullpen. I see a lot of people advocating for the Connor Brogdon, Sir Anthony Dominguez tandem to take over these setup and closer roles. But I mean, people get pretty fantastical. I'm not saying that that's fantastical. People get very emotional about the bullpen, I guess. And, you know, Sir Anthony gave up a home run the other night. Everybody was pretty quick to forgive him because he has been much more effective lately than Knebel, and I think that's totally fair. But, you know, I think there are some arms out there that deserve a shot, you know, deserve a shot at closing out some games because they have been reliable. Those arms do not belong to the body of Jairus Familia, who has a 4.50 ERA through 25 games with the Phillies. I'm just sick to death of seeing this fucking guy come out of the bullpen. I don't want him on the team. Yep. I didn't want him on the team in the first place. Not a good signing. I mean, yeah, he's allowed hits in every appearance he's made since May 31st, which is five. He doesn't walk a ton of guys, and honestly, he doesn't allow a lot of earned runs, but he's one of those guys who just always feels like things are teetering on the verge. And he's multiple times he's entered a situation where the Phillies had a lead and just wasn't able to accomplish that. And, you know, an 8-4 game against the Marlins, that game should be won. That's a one game, like, early on. And we don't, like, I'm not saying start cleaning up the equipment and, you know, start calling Ubers in the sixth inning or anything. I'm just saying an 8-4 lead over one of the worst teams in the National League. Although, you know, it was a lot of, you could see the hints of their young talent, like the heart starting to beat, I feel like, for that team. And they could be a shin kicking upstart in the NL East sooner rather than later.
It's only taken them 15 years.
But still, you know, that's a lead that should hold. That's a lead. And then, honestly, even if you're going to let them back into the game, Rhys Hoskins hitting the solo shot to give them a 9-8 lead, you should be able to hold that lead too. You should be able to get the three outs you need to qualify that as a win. And that's what was so frustrating about that. You know, that the Phillies had that one, they earned that win, and because of their sloppy bullpen arms, they couldn't get it done.
Yeah. Like, I'm here looking at, you know, I'm really looking at Sir Anthony Dominguez, his stats, and after all that he's been through, especially when he had to delay Tommy John surgery for a while because he was stuck out of the country. He had troubles getting back in. Like, it's so pleasing and wonderful to see him. He has a 1.88 ERA. You know, like, this is all good news. I'm so thrilled. 32 strikeouts in 25 games. Like, that's great. I say we take Jairus Familia and trebuchet him anywhere and then bring up Mark Appel. That's my thing now. This is what I'm saying. Mark Appel is at AAA right now. In 16 games, he has a 1.82 ERA. Let's bring him up and see what he can do.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a move that I think the Phillies could be pretty close to making. I mean, Appel's success down there has been documented. I know Alex Coffey had a story about Mark Appel, and I know his name had popped up as like, hey, this guy's doing really well, and it's the kind of arm the Phillies need. You know, this is the kind of boon the Phillies need. Somebody from the farm system who's around, who's not going to be like the next all-star reliever for the Phillies necessarily, but somebody who can come up and contribute. And by contribute, I mean get three outs when the team has a lead. That's really all we're looking for. I feel like the bar is pretty low for success. It's just, you know, get outs. We don't need you to be Mariano Rivera. You just need to show up and get some outs. Michael Kelly debuted for the Phillies and you know, made his Major League Baseball debut last night against the Nationals. And that was very cool to see. Like, okay, we're getting some new arms in here. They made that deal with the Giants to acquire Michael Plassmayer, and yes, he's pitching in AAA now. He's another option. As I said, the Phillies seem to be systematically addressing their issues, even, you know, a month before the trade deadline. So this is encouraging to me. They're not just standing pat. They're not just, you know, Joe Girardi's not just sitting there thinking, well, this is the job and like this is the closer and this is everyone's job and blah, blah, blah. I'm glad that system's out of the picture. I'm glad they're being a little more aggressive about taking on their issues without being crazy. And like I said, I'm encouraged that as this team does have some pretty big issues, but they do seem aware of them, and that is very encouraging.
It's even beyond being aware. Like, now with Girardi gone, it actually feels like there might be some discussion about how to solve these issues. Like, hey, the bullpen sucks, and you know the way that you want to rest the pitchers is not working for us. I don't feel like Joe Girardi would have taken to that, but Rob Thompson's like, yeah, let's do it. It feels like that. I've not been in his office or heard these conversations, but.
Yeah, I mean, Dombrowski's got to be at least fueling this conversation partially. And, you know, he's the one who certainly was involved with the Girardi dismissal. So I feel like that's all just part of the same collective need for improvement. You know, we set up this team. We thought they could succeed like this. Here are the areas where they haven't been succeeding. We're going to address those issues and just try something else. You know, I feel like we've spent a lot of seasons sitting here going, just do something different because this isn't working. You know, not us. People say, well, what's the fix? Who would you put in instead? What's the
answer? Anyone.
And the answer is just, yeah, just try something different, because even if it just is passable, even if it's less worse, then it's a success, because there's been some bottoming out in some key areas of this team in the last few years. Let's talk about these five games against the Nationals. Like I said, they already played the first one last night, the Phillies, with a resounding 10-1 win. Everybody in the lineup had a hit, but nobody had too many. Only Kyle Schwarber and Nick Castellanos had more than one. And that's encouraging in its own little way, I feel like, even just in a one-game snapshot, to just see, oh, comprehensive contributions up and down the lineup. That's good. We also got to check in with old friends like Mikel Franco and Cesar Hernandez and watch them commit the errors they used to make as Phillies, contributing to the pounding they received from the Phillies. Let's quick sidebar here. The Nationals, I'd say, have been humbled since their World Series title in 2019 that no one remembers.
Immediately since.
On August 25th, 2020, they tweeted out their infamous "Beating Philadelphia isn't as hard as Philadelphians say it is" tweet. Which is funny for a lot of reasons. I mean, I always have to go back to the fact that, like, no Philadelphians thought it was hard to beat the Phillies. We all hated the Phillies. We were very pissed at them.
Yes.
They sucked. Their bullpen sucked even more back then. It was a dog shit year to be watching the Phillies blow games because of their bullpens. And the Nationals like, oh, you guys think you're so good? And we're like, no. No, we do not think we're good. It was just a tone-deaf, dumb little tweet trying to be cute. And it is hilarious how much they've eaten shit for that. Since that tweet on August 25th, 2020, just to catch people up, they have lost 21 of 30 games to the Phillies. And frankly, the three games they won against them in 2020 shouldn't count, because the Phillies' bullpen was an abomination to which the only cure was fire. So... It's basically cheating to play against the 2020 Phillies bullpen, I would say. I think that that's just as bad as putting up cameras and doing a banging scheme to alert batters. Just as bad.
Imagine if, I mean, that was the 60-game season, right?
Correct.
2020. Imagine if we had to deal with that bullpen over 162 games.
Yeah, seriously.
I know.
What a gift.
We got so lucky, weirdly.
What a gift. Well, like I said, last night, the offense, everybody found a way to connect, typically off Patrick Corbin, who sucks. But we all know that this offense is being carried. There's guys who have been contributing more, guys who've been contributing less. We want to see more from in the weeks ahead. You know, I thought it was just a quick, again, side note, encouraging to see Nick Castellanos have a multi-hit night. You know, I know it was just against the Nationals, and it was just against Patrick Corbin, who, again, sucks. But... it was nice to see him make some solid contact, because he's been flailing. He's been getting a little cranky with umpires, but never to the point where he's like really viscerally upset. So I don't know. He's just at this kind of like, I'm just waiting for him to find his tempo, I guess, like a more upbeat tempo.
I think a series against the Nationals could be something to get him started. You know, beating up on terrible pitching, like the Marlins have some decent pitching, and I'm sure that didn't help Nick Castellanos, but the Nationals have some pretty bad pitching, as we saw. So if he's, you know, if he can hone in on these next few games, these next four games as a chance for him to be like, all right, I can get into a groove. I can really do this. Then, you know, I think this will be good for him. I'm very hopeful. Trying to be hopeful.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing. Going against teams that are bad, which, by the way, the Nationals in the month of June, their starting rotation has a 7.01 ERA. So this is a pretty good opportunity to get back on track, because there's a good chance you're just taking batting practice out there, especially when you're Nick Castellanos. It's not like his success is paramount to them moving forward, but you do just want to see, you just want to see him reach his like default setting, which I believe is much more productive than he's been right now. In his career, he's one of these guys, just like a lot of the guys on the Phillies, whose success typically comes in June. He's a .291 career hitter in June with a .817 OPS and 24 home runs. You know, he's hit more home runs in September, which again could really come in handy for the Phillies. But like, this is a month where his bat tends to surge a bit. And Schwarber kind of follows the same pattern. Schwarber and Castellanos both pop off in June, and then they come back in like August and then September, and they pop off then as well. And speaking of Schwarber, after hitting .200 in both April and May, he is hitting .302 in June with a .774 slugging percentage. I tweeted out this morning, in fact, in the National League, the top three slugging percentages belong to Kyle Schwarber, Rhys Hoskins, and Bryce Harper. The Phillies are 3-for-3 in the top three slugging percentages in the National League for the month of June. That's a big deal.
Yeah, that's how it's supposed to work. It's what we wanted.
Seriously. Schwarber's OPS is up on the International Space Station. He has already bested his monthly total for the season with 7 home runs, and there are still 16 games to go this month. Tragically, after these 5 games, the Phillies don't go back to Washington until the end of the season in late September, early October, which, again, also could be really good news, depending on the situation. Schwarber typically hits .279 there with a .1063 OPS in his career. He actually just played his 51st game at Citizens Bank Park, bypassing Nationals Park as his second most played-in venue in baseball behind Wrigley Field. It's no secret that Washington is a ballpark where Kyle Schwarber tends to feel pretty comfortable, and June is the month where he tends to get comfortable. So this is actually a very good time to be playing the Nationals and having Kyle Schwarber in your lineup. His career June numbers: he's a .260 hitter with a .963 OPS in June. He has 42 career home runs and 91 RBI. Like I said, he's part of the top three slugging percentages in the National League, all of which belong to Phillies. Fangraphs has him hitting hard hit balls in 50% of his contact in June, tied with Aaron Judge for the second highest frequency of hard hit balls in baseball. Hoskins is, you wouldn't be tied for Aaron Judge in a lot of things, and that's not bad. Hoskins is at about 45%, which is 16th between Manny Machado and Marcelo Ozuna, also pretty good company at the plate. Schwarber is hitting fly balls 50% of the time when he makes contact this month. Also feels absurdly high. And 36.8% of those fly balls have become home runs.
Wow.
The good news is, like I said, he typically surges in August and September as well. In August, he has a career 888 OPS and 40 home runs. In September, an 843 OPS and 24 home runs. And just speaking of the offense, as a quick side note, Alec Bohm has hit line drives in 28.2% of his batted balls, the most on the Phillies, and tied with Eduardo Escobar of the Mets for 9th highest line drive percentage in the National League.
Ooh.
That's also good. And that's that sneaky way that Bohm can be productive, and the way that he snuck it in last year when things like he still had that like, oh, it's Alec Bohm, he's struggling at the plate. And then you would check the stats and be like, well, hang on, he's actually like been singling a lot. It just gets overlooked because he's not hitting near the top of the order. Maybe he's not knocking in a ton of runs, but like he's connecting, he's making solid contact, he's making hard contact, and he's driving the ball. So that's also good news. You know, you don't need Alec Bohm to be the best hitter in your lineup, But it's nice to see him find ways to come through wherever you put him. So, yeah, I mean, just to start with Schwarber, Liz, like Kyle Schwarber has helped carry this offense. And, you know, it's not like Bryce Harper's really turned it off lately, but he's kind of been joined in effectiveness by Schwarber and Hoskins. And yeah, just starting with Schwarber first, how crucial is it that Schwarber was able to turn it on in June?
I mean, pretty crucial. Excuse me. I'm looking at, through the season until June, he was sitting 185. Which is very bad. His season low for like after the month of April, which is always low. Like in June, in May, he got down to like 181. Like we're not paying him to do that. But like he is in the zone. Watching him hit those home runs last night, this is his second two homer game of June. And like they were skybound immediately. Like, the way he was swinging, it's like, I know this is a home run before I've even swung my bat, which is incredible to see. I'm so glad that he's doing really well, because again, I think it takes the pressure off of everyone else. If everyone can contribute at some level, that's how you win games. Not everyone has to be operating, you know, at the, you know, tip top of their ability level. But if everyone can find a way to contribute, that's how you win, and that's how the Phillies are doing it.
Can I ask I know I accused you of being too negative, and I'm just asking a question here.
Okay. That,
you know, yeah, it's great to see all these guys hitting. It's oh yes, they've come alive. They're smashing the ball. They're hitting home runs. This is how the team was set up to succeed, and they are succeeding that way. But given the context of this, and we'll get more into this in a second, that like they're playing in a division where it's tough to find other teams that aren't riding pretty hot win streaks at the moment, teams the Phillies want to be able to get past. But if you're orchestrating a lineup of guys whose bats come alive in June, that means you're risking exactly what has happened this season and some of the past few seasons, where maybe not punting on the first 2 months of the season, but you're putting a lot more pressure on guys like Bryce Harper, who like can contribute from day one till the end of the season. Typically, you know, obviously there's ups and downs, but there was a reason we were like, Bryce Harper is carrying this offense and he can't do it alone, even with this offense, which is supposed to be a way better offense than the Phillies have had for years. But like, you're kind of putting yourself in an 8-week hole when your guy who's your MVP for June can't even hit 200 for the first 2 months of the season. I mean, that's the narrative we're talking about here. This team has looked great and I'm very encouraged by them, and I want to watch every game and I'm having fun watching them, but they put themselves in a hole. And the reason they need to win so much right now is because they're in that hole still. You know, yeah, they're over 500, just barely, but they had to like win 9 games in a row to get out of that hole. And now they're in the NL East hole, where there's two other teams that are doing a really good job of outpacing them in the wins category. So, you know, I'm just saying, relying on guys whose bats don't come alive till June, it also has its downfall.
Yeah, that is true, but it's not like that was intentional. It's not, you know, I definitely
But you could see, you could look at their stats. Everybody's talking about, oh, Schwarber comes alive in June. Castellanos is the same way. Hoskins is the same way. It's not like these guys are strangers. You can look at the stat sheet and be like, oh, yeah, well, it's okay, he's a slow starter. You can't put a bunch of slow starters in the lineup and not be under 500 by the end of May. I don't know. I guess that's my point.
I know. I've never considered like when a player gets hot as part of their, you know, why to sign them. That's actually really interesting, because maybe the Phillies, you know, did unintentionally set themselves up to sort of have a tough couple of months to start the season. But from what I've seen of this team, they've done nothing everyone on that team has done nothing but play from behind. And that's what they're comfortable with. I mean, I do have some faith that they'll be able to keep it up, you know, especially like knowing the Castellanos gets really hot in September, and with global warming, it will continue to be pretty warm throughout the summer. Yeah.
Hitting season all year long, baby.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the end of the world. But before that, whee!
Let's enjoy it while we can, folks.
Do you want to hear the horrifying truth, or do you want to see me hit a few dingers?
We dingers! All know the answer to that. Yeah.
Well, I mentioned Rhys Hoskins as well. In the last 2 weeks, Hoskins has hit 365 with a 1239 OPS in 13 games. In that time,
that
he
streak
has,
we were looking for.
Hell, man, this is a bit more prolonged. 2 weeks? That's a long Hoskins streak.
Yeah,
and he was on one before this. Then he kind of tapered off for a couple of games, and now it's back. So if you stretch this back to the beginning of his last spasm, it's probably almost a month at this point. He's reached base safely 27 times in 60 plate appearances.
Ooh.
That's pretty good. That's
pretty
good. His five home runs in the last 2 weeks, four in the last week alone. In the month of June total, he's blowing out his first 8 weeks of the season, smashing the ball for a 357 batting average and 1188 OPS with five home runs. Again, another key part of the offense and, you know, another streaky guy. We've defined Hoskins as a streaky guy. I've called them spasms because that's what they feel more like spasms to me. But again, this is as good a time as any for him to be on one and for it to continue. I mean, I almost forgot that, yeah, he's streaky, and as little as you believe in him when he's at his lowest, when he comes up and he's on one like he is right now, my confidence in him is just sky high. Like, he comes up,
oh, yeah.
I'm like, oh, yeah, this run's coming in, or, like, he's getting on base. And he's just – and it's not just home runs. He's knocking doubles. Obviously, he's good at getting on base. But, like, you know, he can also rely on him to carry the team like he tried to in that loss against the Marlins, where he was like, I will win us this game. And he did everything he could to do it. It was just – it was the bullpen's fault they blew it. But, yeah, man, he is going to stand out forever in my mind, no matter what happens with this team, no matter what happens with him individually. He's going to stand out in my mind as somebody I would never believe in when he was in the middle of a slump, and someone my confidence, like, I'm so comforted when he comes up to the plate right now, especially with runners on base, because he's just going to hit the shit out of the ball. Like, it's crazy. I wonder what, like, the gears turning, like, behind the scenes are responsible for this, for the way he plays and the way he's able to produce. It's got to be like a mental thing of some kind, but at the moment, I don't even care why, because he can't be stopped.
I would like to present to you my thesis statement. Joe Great. Girardi, colon, kryptonite? Question mark? That's all I've got, because everyone seems to, I mean, the month has changed and all that, but, like, everyone seems to have sort of, like, gotten better, hit better, had more confidence. It's like a cloud has lifted. You know, I was thinking the other day, like, I have a couple of jerseys, and I have an Utley jersey and a Halliday jersey, and I was thinking, I don't have any jerseys for any Phillies player that has been on the team in the last 8 years, 6 years, five, something like that, 7 years, at least for Utley. And I was thinking, who do I want? And the only name that came up was Rhys Hoskins. That's it. That's the only player whose jersey I would want, period. You know,
Well, it's because there's an attachment to him. You know, he's been around for a few years. He's a Philly. Like, he's only ever been a Philly. He's a 5-year veteran at this point. Like, he is a Philly. He's a Philly. And if they were any better, he'd be considered part of the core that got them there. But, you know, they haven't made the playoffs, so he's just kind of been around.
I mean, if they make the playoffs this year, he definitely will be. You know,
yeah, absolutely.
He'll be the guy who's been there since the start. Is there anyone else? Maybe Aaron Nola.
Nola
has been on the team since 2017. I'll have to look and see if anyone else has, but I don't really think so.
Well, the rest of the guys, well, I mean, like, Herrera, but...
He was suspended and sucks, so he does not count. We're not going to count him.
Obviously, we don't count him. Yeah. But yeah, other than that, I mean, most of those guys, like, Kingery was here and gone, but, like, he's considered a failed story for the Phillies.
Guy.
So far. And then the daycare guys like Bohm, Vierling, Moniak, Maton, like those guys, they don't have Reese's longevity, you know, his experience as a member of the Phillies yet. So yeah, he's kind of in a unique spot where we've naturally grown an attachment for him, even though he's infuriated us at times, because he has been such, like, a team leader and a good guy with the fans and just like a pleasure to watch, especially obviously when he's actually hitting the ball. And when he is hitting the ball, like now, it's such a huge payoff. It's so, like, he's such a tremendous contributor and offensive powerhouse. So yeah, he's kind of like the Philliest Philly right now, him and Aaron Nola. I don't think anybody else falls into that category.
Nope. It's like you said, it's always encouraging to see him do this, because you know when he comes up to the plate, there's a greater chance than not that he's going to do something good.
Yeah. Well, let's run through real quick what the issue is for this team. A couple of the problems they face. Despite all their success, yet they are still 8.5 games behind the Mets and 4 games behind the Braves. How staggering is this Braves run of 14 straight wins? And could it have come at a more infuriating time?
I hate it so much. Fuck those guys. I hate it. You know, even I think who was it? One of their, it's not Acuna. One of their players like fractured their foot. And they're just like, we're just going to keep on winning.
Albies. Yep. That's a key loss, too.
They don't give a shit. They don't care. Like, we're just going to keep going. We've got everything we need. I'm just like, please lose. And I'm looking to see who they're facing this weekend. And it's the fucking Cubs.
Hell yeah. They're playing through the same underbelly of the senior circuit that the Phillies are. And they're doing exactly what they need to do with it. Yeah, I feel like there's not a lot of focus on this aspect of the Philly success at the moment. Like, we're taking the healthy approach and not getting too far ahead of ourselves. We have to trust the Phillies' success before we start wielding it like a weapon. And the Braves are just looming large. In June, they are hitting .292 as a team. The Phillies, .283. Yeah, they are just like a half step to a full step ahead of the Phillies in a bunch of categories, one of them being team batting average and home runs. The Phillies have 28 home runs. That's a ton in June. The Braves, 35.
Oh my God.
Phillies, yeah, 58 extra base hits in June. The Braves, 68. The Phillies, .526 slugging percentage. The Braves, .569. The Phillies, .356 on base percentage. The Braves, .355. The Braves have a 151 weighted runs created plus. The Phillies, .143. And the Phillies are striking out less and walking more than the Braves, but they are hitting more line drives than the Braves as well, but they are hitting fewer of their fly balls for home runs, and few of their batted balls qualify as hard hit. But here's one that's interesting. The Braves have grounded into 5 double plays all month. The Phillies, 12. And there's more space between that stat than a lot of the other ones I looked at.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The first thing that came to mind was Mr. JT Realmuto and how many times we have watched him ground into double plays. He has grounded into 4 of their 12 double plays. The second highest in baseball in June. He's tied with, I think, Tommy Pham, and they're both behind CJ Cron for just getting himself and other people out. He is driving the ball straight into the ground right now. Last year on June 17th, JT Realmuto was hitting .286 with 6 home runs and an .860 OPS. This year, he's hitting .243 with a .678 OPS and 3 home runs. He's grounded into those 4 double plays this month alone. Last year at this time, he hadn't grounded into any. Last year, he had a 51.7% ground ball percentage. This year, 46.8. So he's hitting ground balls at a less frequent clip, even though it feels like he's not. And I mean, as a catcher, his top job is to handle the staff and be like good with them. And then you always say anything you get out of a catcher at the plate is a bonus because you want him to be a field general. You want him to be able to talk with the staff and communicate with the pitching staff and get the best possible performance out of them and know what pitches to call and what situation. And, he's not in charge of who comes into the game at what time, but it is his job to know all the pitchers well enough that he can get the best performance out of them. And I the pitching staff is performing. The bullpen sucks. The starters have been really good. We'll get to that in a second. But other than that, at the plate, he is just not, he's a non-factor at the plate, and he's worse than a non-factor. He's ending innings with double plays. He's getting other people out who have done their jobs and gotten on base. And honestly, what's this shit with the ball slipping out of his glove all the fucking time?
I don't know.
Can't catch the ball right now. It's like somebody's slathering his glove in hot oil before the fucking game starts. And he just can't squeak. He can't catch that fly ball. I'm sorry, the foul ball behind home plate. Throws, I feel like, get by him a lot more. Like that play with Ranger Suarez, it wasn't a great throw, but it squirted out of his glove. I mean, it just feels like there's time after time the ball's just like not staying in his glove. And I mean, that feels more like a fluky thing, especially with a guy like JT Realmuto, but nobody should be calling this guy the best catcher in baseball right now. And I think, he would agree with that.
Yeah. I mean, I would hope he'd agree with that. I don't think he speaks enough to really agree with or disagree with anything, but there's going to be complaints that he's not earning his salary. I remind people that at this point, most guys are being on big contracts are being paid for their early contributions for which they got paid almost nothing for. So keeping that in mind, it's important. But also, we're paying, what, $25 million for this? $20 million for him to, for the ball to fall out of his glove and for him to, like, seriously rescind his previously sparkling, you know, caught stealing rate, which is one of the things we all noticed, that we all knew that he was good at and that he had been good at. And now he is just not doing that very well.
I noticed you cited the amount of money he costs, which I believe we've said in the past, well, it's not our money, so it doesn't matter how much. So, does that matter now that he is displeasing in his performance?
I mean, it doesn't really matter, but you sort of look at a salary like that for any player is what they what someone is expected to produce. Like, he's being paid like the best catcher in baseball, because for a while he was, and now he's kind of not. I mean, I have faith that he'll figure it out. I mean, it's rare for a player to just totally lose all skill in like all but one area of his job.
Do you watch the Phillies or not? Because I don't think it's that rare for a player to suddenly lose all of his skill. No, I'm kidding. But I mean, yeah, no, you're right. I think there's
permanently.
We haven't seen the last of JT Realmuto.
Exactly.
I think he's got, even if he has like a down year this year, I think he's got like a solid month in him. You know, even if this is like the worst year of JT Realmuto's career or something, I don't think this is like the beginning of the end. I think this is just, and I honestly, the ball squirting out of his glove stuff kind of tells me that. Because again, that's all very fluky and just piling on and adding to, I'm sure, the mental stress of being like, crap, shit, son of a bitch, I grounded the fucking ball right into the fucking ground again. Like, you know, we've all been at our various jobs stuck in cycles of frustrating failures.
Where all you do is fuck up for like two solid weeks.
Seriously. Yeah. And he's fucking just spiraling right now. And, you know, I want him to do better. And it's frustrating when he kills a rally. But yeah, right now that's an area where they really need to improve. And just to touch on the pitching before we go to commercial, the Phillies starters have a 2.91 ERA in June, the fourth best ERA in Major League Baseball. They have 69 strikeouts to 15 walks this month, 86.2 innings pitched, tied with Seattle for the fifth most innings pitched in baseball. So the starting rotation is eating some innings. Like, they are pitching deep into games. So if you're somebody who worries about that harming them on the back end, maybe you're a little concerned, but I think right now you got to go with the hot hand, and the hot hands are the ones in the rotation at the moment. Mm-hmm. They're keeping the ball on the ground with a 48% ground ball percentage. Of course, the Braves are one of two teams with a higher one. Meanwhile, in the bullpen, 4.12 ERA for the month, 44 strikeouts, 18 walks, and 39 and a third innings. I feel like in most seasons you're saying bullpen's gotta be better, even if you're a good team. Like, that's the area where you're always feeding new arms just to see what happens, and maybe you can stabilize it for a playoff run. Rarely do you have, like, you know, the same bullpen for multiple years in a row performing with the exact same level of success. But still, this is a weak spot for the Phillies. We all know it. We talked about it at the top. There's some clear problem areas, and the Phillies are starting to address it. So hopefully things improve there, because you could really use some confidence going into a one-run game in the late innings and not feel like, oh man, this guy who doesn't have an out pitch is coming into pitch just because we call him the closer. But I think those days are over. This team is going to be a little more aggressive about addressing its problems, and, you know, that's one of them. So we'll take a quick commercial break. When we come back, we'll dive into the Mason jar.
Ooh.
Missed it last week because there were more important things to talk about, but this week we will give you biographies and just a little more inside info on a couple of guys from the non-playoff era of Phillies history from 2012 to 2021. Hopefully this year is the end of that. As you all know, we have a glass Mason jar named for Roger Mason, in which there are handwritten pieces of paper with the names of every player. Well, not every player, but the less famous players from all of those teams from 2012 to 2021. And each week we reach into the jar, pull out two names, and the following week we tell you a little bit about them that we assume you just don't know. This is our way of getting around having to do actual chronicles of the 2012 season on its 10-year anniversary and all the subsequent seasons, which aren't fun to talk about because the Phillies were bad. So when we come back, we'll give you a little more information on Austin Davis and Grady Sizemore. Those are our names of the week, and we'll get to that right after this. Well, we're back on Continued Success, and we're, of course, going to talk about everyone's favorite Phillies topic at the moment, Grady Sizemore. Who was he? Where did he come from? Why was he named that? Why did he come here? Was he good when he was here? Ha ha ha. Of course not. But yeah, Liz, I believe you had Grady Sizemore to look into this week. So why don't you start us off with the Grady Sizemore story?
Indeed, I do. All right. So let's meet Grady Sizemore, everybody. Grady Sizemore was... Hello. Grady Sizemore was born somewhere. Probably Washington State, which is where he graduated high school. He played basketball, football, and baseball, though no details of his prowess really exist, except at the time of graduation, he was his high school's all-time leader in rushing yards with 3,081. We don't know what college he would have chosen, he would have gone to, because the Expos, who took him in the third round of the 2000 draft, offered him $2 million to prevent him from going. He took them up on it, and they repaid him 2 years later by trading him, get ready, him, Cliff Lee, Brandon Phillips, and Lee Stevens to Cleveland in exchange for Bartolo Colon and Tim Drew.
That's a hell of a trade.
I know.
Boy, that's like a core... Cleveland team that yeah. they just traded the entire core of a Cleveland. Wow, that's huge.
Yeah. So he made his major league debut for Cleveland in 2004, which wasn't anything spectacular, but in 2005 he took off. For 4 years he was pretty much the shit. He hit 281, he hit 107 homers, stole 115 bases, finished in the top 15 of MVP voting three times, once in the top 10, and then in the fourth year, once at 23. He was voted an All-Star three times, won two Gold Gloves, one Silver Slugger. He played 162 games twice, and the other 2 years played 157 and 158. In 2007, he hit four home runs in his first six games, and he went to the Home Run Derby three consecutive years. The good times... seemed like they would never stop. And then the rest of his career happened. He was a stud. And we'll get back to what a stud he was. I'm going to speed through this because there's something we'll need to talk about in just a moment. He had a subpar season in 2009 ended early with elbow surgery to fix something that had been bothering him since spring training. He played 33 games in 2010. Before having microfracture surgery on his left knee. He played 71 games in 2011 and then lost the rest of the season to various other knee issues and hernia surgery. And then he missed the next 2 years. All of them.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
Due to knee and back issues. Like, it was over at this point. I remember this period and being like, everyone's like, where is he? When is he going to come back? And I'm like, is he? Like, two seasons is a lot of time to spend out of baseball while you're still in baseball, technically.
Yeah, he was, he lives in my brain. You know, the stud part has kind of been overtaken by the guy who was just a flesh sack full of bone shards by the end of his career.
Pretty much. So in 2014, I think he spent a little bit of time with the Indians, but in 2014, he spent just a few months with the Red Sox, who released him in mid-June. And that is when his pretty much full season with the Phillies began. He spent the rest of 2014 with them. And then the first part of 2015 until he was released in June. And with the Phillies, he actually wasn't too bad. He played in 99 games, hit 250. Let's see, where is the home run count here? Three home runs. That is bad. I'll say three home runs is probably bad. But, you know, he hit 250, which is at least semi-serviceable. But he was released, and he spent, another 50 games or so with the Rays, and he retired. Now I believe he's a front office assistant or advisor or something for Cleveland. At least last we heard.
He went to Tampa at the ass end of his career with his broken body, having like not really gotten there as an effective player for the Phillies, as they were like, oh, Grady Sizemore. And I remember thinking like, what a grab. Like, this could be like their guy who was a star, and then like they get to be the team that nurses him back to a redemption narrative. Like, this could be, and then it just never happened. And then of course he goes to Tampa, and yeah, he only plays like 58 games since the last Major League Baseball of his career. But I don't know if you noticed, but his numbers are like a little significantly better than they were in Philadelphia. Like, he's got a 746 OPS with Tampa, never even cracked 700 with the Phillies.
Nope.
And yeah, just was able to produce a little more, hit six home runs for the Rays in 2015. Yeah, yeah, six home runs total in 2015. Zero for the Phillies, all six for the Rays. I mean, you know, 12 doubles to the five he had in Philadelphia. Like, it's just funny to see that. Like, the Rays get somebody like that, and they can squeeze whatever's left out. The Phillies get somebody like that, and they're like, I don't know, the bathroom's locked. Do you know where the key is? Like, that's their best. That's like the best things they can offer. It's, oh my God, it's hilarious.
So I've sped through all that mostly to get to this. A piece on ESPN from 2006, 2 years after he made his debut, by Allison Glock, senior ESPNW writer. This is when ESPNW was trying to be its own thing. And you can... All right. This is where sports journalism for women was at the time. The title of this article is Grady Sizemore is a ladies' man.
Oh, no.
Oh. I'm going to read some excerpts just because I have to. I have to. To know the man, you must first get past the porn star name. This is how it opens.
Well, didn't even register that you could read it like that. Wow.
You must, me either. You must forget, if you can, that he looks like Clark Kent. Or a young Jimmy Smits, or, when he lifts his eyebrows, like Elvis, before Elvis moves to Graceland and figured out how beautiful he was. What?
This is funny because these are like references your aunt would make to who the attractive men comparisons should be. Jimmy Smits and Elvis Presley? Mm-mm.
You must look beyond these superficial distractions into his heart, into his soul. It is there you'll discover the elemental bits that combust to form what very well may be the perfect man.
Okay.
Not so perfect. Not perfect so much in the good catch sort of way. Although there is that, as the fan sites and the blogs and the breathless members of Grady's Ladies will attest. It isn't every baseball player who triggers a sea of will you marry me signs when he comes to the plate. Not every player inspires a 200% increase in female viewership, a $275 36-inch bobblehead that looks nothing like him, but sells out nonetheless, and a line of fast-selling baby doll tees printed with the words Mrs. Sizemore across the bosom.
Is this that uncommon? I mean, kind of. It does feel, it almost like feels like Beatlemania almost for one guy, which I do think, okay, that's kind of... But also, I don't know, man. Like, is this how you thought of Grady Sizemore?
No.
I went back to his baseball reference page to be like, okay, was he like a total dreamboat? And like, I don't want to get into people's appearances and stuff, but like, this would
He's
not
fine.
Be my first guess if you put up a bunch of pictures of people and you're like, who did women absolutely go batshit bananas for while they were like playing baseball? I'm not sure I'd guess Grady Sizemore first. He looks kind of just like sleepy.
Yep. It's really something. I'll do a few more highlights here. Let's see. Oh, in 2006, he signed a $23.5 million 6-year contract. That is, that was considered to be a premier contract at the time, I believe, for someone like Sizemore, who had done so well, which is something to, wow. Here's a sentence. There's more, of course. Grady Sizemore III is close to his parents. Mom Donna is an accountant. Dad Grady II is a State Farm claims rep. Corey, his only brother, is also his best friend. Grady, who stands 6'2 and weighs 200 pounds, is smart and funny and well-dressed. He was born August 2nd, 1982, into a mixed-race household. Mom is white, dad is black. And even this gave him no baggage, no identity crisis, no issues to overcome. People just weren't like that around me. Now, I didn't know he was mixed race.
I did not know that either.
No, and I'm going to say people just weren't like that around me, maybe, because he can absolutely pass as not biracial. That is definitely a thing in the community, that people who can pass definitely are treated better. So this is definitely quite a relic of something from the past.
Jeez. And that's considered, it's honestly, it's like a little hair raising that it's, this is considered, oh yeah, this is a story for ESPNW. Like this is because this is what like women want to read about. This is a women's sports story. And I mean, you know, I'm not like, what if it was the other way? But like, also, what if it was the other way and it was like a regular ESPN article written about how hot a female athlete was? Like, that's obviously not going to fly. So like, this is a dicey yeah. area.
I have just another little bit, which I found really funny. Most of the Indians live in the suburbs. Sizemore prefers downtown. On a late spring weekend with the Pirates in town, his loft is largely empty. He has plans to decorate it in a masculine modern style with lots of leather and chrome and expensive rugs. But for now, it holds only the odd chair and a half-empty closet. There is a bed unmade.
See, my office is set up the same way, deeply masculine, except I nailed the rugs to the ceiling and ripped all the leather off the chairs and used that as the rugs. What was the third thing she said that was very masculine?
Leather, chrome, and expensive rugs. Leather. This was chrome.
Chrome, yeah. Wall-to-wall chrome, yeah, in my office as well. It's gleaming. Yeah, it's blinding, really. You walk in here, and you take out your phone, and the light comes on, and yeah, you're done for the rest of the day. Just spots in your vision nonstop. So, yeah, it's very manly in here. Very manly. Grady and I are like, very alike.
Yes. There's a bed unmade, and in front of it, a television stack with DVDs. Munich, King Kong, Carlito's Way, the Deadwood box set. My brain moves a mile a minute, Sizemore says, gesturing to the tower of films. I own every movie ever made. I have a habit. And apparently an indiscriminate eye. I know if Grady liked a movie, it probably sucked, said Pirates left fielder Jason Bay. Jason Bay, one of Sizemore's closest friends.
This kind of means nothing unless we know what Jason Bay's tastes are, you know? Like,
well, this might help inform you. He thinks everything is good because he sees the good in everything.
Oh, that's nice.
Yes. Closer with Clive Owen, says Sizemore. Fucking hilarious. When it is mentioned that Closer isn't really a comedy so much as a meditation on the essential loneliness of being, Sizemore chuckles. Sure, but Clive was still hilarious.
That is not a hilarious movie. I mean, it's hilarious because I don't like it. I think it's super sappy and over the top. But like, yeah, it's really funny that they had this exchange.
Yep, I'm just thinking of that. Yep. Yeah, it's the rest of this talks a little bit about Bay thinking about trying to set Sizemore up with a celebrity. He doesn't know any, it seems. But he is definitely brainstorming. You see, after a game, a 4-1 win over the Pirates, Sizemore lifts weights, showers, and heads into the rainy Cleveland night to have a few drinks. At a pub by his apartment, he stares at a clip of Barry Bonds just missing a home run. I love what he does for the game, Sizemore says. It's 1 a.m., last call. Sizemore is trying to decide if he wants to hit another club, one with dancing and, presumably, girls. He wants to go out, but there will be traffic and lots of fans. Lots of fans. He decides to walk home and instead and watch the finale of The OC. To see who dies, he says, with a wink.
What? Yes. Why a wink?
I do not know.
This is funny because it sounds like the reporter went out with him and the story was like, I spent a night out with Grady Sizemore. And then like after a place, he's like, yeah, I'm just going to head home. And they're like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Yes, see, Brittany Binger, B-I-N-G-E-R, so it's Binger or Binger. Binger gained notoriety because she's a former Playboy model. She's a June 2007's Playmate of the Month.
How about it?
Yeah.
Like joining the Reed Brignac Club.
I totally forgot about that. Yep, he got married, I believe, in 2012.
Congrats, Grady.
Yes.
Your time as a Philly was deeply forgettable.
Yeah. There was really nothing significant to talk about him with the Phillies, which is why I focused on that absolutely ridiculous fucking article.
Yeah, there's nothing to really put together based on his Phillies time. Much like our next Philly from the non-playoff era, Austin Davis. There are a lot of Austin Davises out there.
Yeah,
there was an Austin Davis at the same time who was a football player. There was an Austin Davis who was like a douchebag poet I found at the same time who was in high school. You know, like a lot of pitchers, Austin Davis's last year in Philadelphia was 2020. He was drafted by them in 2014, promoted to the big leagues in 2018, and appeared in 50 games in which he allowed 42 runs, 38 of them earned, amounting to a 5.86 career ERA as a Phillies reliever. He throws a four-seamer and a slider, sprinkles in a changeup, and chucks an elusive curve once every full moon. He is still in baseball, having traveled that famous road between Philadelphia and Boston, walked by his colleagues like Heath Embry, Nick Pivetta, and Brandon Workman. The difference is that Davis has a 1.46 ERA with the Red Sox this year after 25 games. Love it when guys just figure it out. On May 15th this year, he made his first big league start against the Rangers, actually, and threw two innings of a bullpen game, allowing only a walk. Davis, you may recall from his Phillies days as the guy who was momentarily shamed for having a little card with a scouting report on it. You remember this?
Oh, yes.
This was classic moment for, well, exactly who we're going to talk about in a second. It was September 1st, 2018. The Phillies were 72-63, three games out of first after spending the better part of a month there earlier in the summer. This was not a lost cause. This was contention. Davis was out there in relief of Eddie Ramos after a bumpy Zach Eflin start, and he was on his way to allowing three more runs in before the Phillies' 7-1 defeat. But before that happened, as the Cubs' Addison Russell came to the plate, Davis took a little card out of his back pocket to check the scouting report. The game was set to continue as normal until Joe West, umpiring third, realized nobody had looked in his direction or paid him any attention for a minute or two, so he trundled out to the mound, snatched the card out of Davis's hand, and waddled back to third base, claiming that having the card was a violation of Rule 602C7, which states that the pitcher can't have on his person or in his possession any foreign substance. That is, of course, not related to paper. Or, you know, like maybe sandpaper, I guess. They could run. That is, of course, not related to these things, which Davis was far from the only pitcher to use one of these scouting reports, and I am positive not the first pitcher Joe West had ever seen use one of these things, which, you know, again, is just classic Joe West. He just felt like walking into the narrative. It's not even like the neighborhood rule, you know, tagging second place on a double play where guys just kind of get that call, or at least used to just get that call, mm-hmm. If they were reasonably close to the bag, like a general understanding that, like, yeah, we just don't call this. No, this is something that just is not against the rules, that Joe West said was against the rules just for a chance to insert himself into the game, and did so. Later on, Major League Baseball reminded everyone that the scouting report cards many pitchers used throughout the league were, in fact, totally legal. I don't believe Joe West ever apologized or even offered any kind of, oh yeah, my bad, whoops, did my job totally and completely wrong on purpose kind of statement. Nope, he just, you know, went back to what he was doing and inserted himself into more games until he finally retired and started a dipshit podcast that I forgot about.
Which no one has talked about for a while. Thank our lucky stars.
I thought we were going to get weekly quotes from that thing. I totally fucking forgot. It's tremendous. Austin Davis had come from the desert out in Scottsdale, Arizona, playing for the Desert Mountain High School. His senior year, he was considered part of the backbone of the squad with its elite pitching. One of his teammates out there? Dylan Cousins. That's interesting.
Wow.
That they both played at the same high school and wound up both playing for the Phillies. Maybe at the same time. But Cousins got tossed off the team midway through their senior year for shoving one of his coaches in the dugout and telling him to, quote, fuck off. Oh. Keith Law said it gave Cousins a reputation as a bully and turned a lot of scouts off him. And, like, given his Twitter presence the past few years, I can see that.
I can definitely see that.
Austin Davis, his nickname is Big Fudge. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah, Big Fudge. He used it as the name on the back of his jersey for Players Weekend in 2018. This is all from the Daily News that year. What's up with Austin Davis having Big Fudge on his back this weekend? To my friends, I'm big and I was a little fat coming out of college, said the 6'4" Davis, who was listed at 245 pounds. I was pushing 255. I was a little overweight, and there was just one instance that kind of made it stick. We were at a pool party, and I sat down in a chair. The chair broke under me, and that kind of solidified Big Fudge. They also just called me fat or tubby, just joking, and when I broke through the chair, Big Fudge was born. Davis will wear his Big Fudge jersey this weekend against the Blue Jays, but he will not see any game action as he's on the disabled list with a sore back. The left-handed reliever can be activated as early as Monday. The Big Fudge nickname was inspired from the sitcom How I Met Your Mother, which was on TV when Davis was in college at Cal State Bakersfield. The Phillies drafted him in the 12th round of the 2014 draft, and 6 months later, he shed some of his fudge. Weird. Weird way to put that.
Yeah.
Honestly, it was by accident, Davis said. I went to Nicaragua and played there in the winter of 2015, and the food wasn't bad, but there wasn't that much around. You had to get your own pregame and postgame meals, so there wasn't a lot of food. I ended up losing like 20 pounds while I was there. You tried to eat as much as you could, but it's 90 degrees and humid. He said his friends were thrilled with his jersey selection and tried to purchase it online after Davis sent them a picture. The neon red and blue jerseys also have a patch on the sleeve where each player can thank people who helped them reach the majors. Davis thanked his wife, his agent, former first-rounder Luke Haggerty, who has worked with Davis since he was in high school, and former Royals infielder Buddy Biancalana, who talks to Davis twice a week about focus training. They all played a role in Davis's journey that led him to the major leagues in June. And one of the first things the Phillies asked Davis after he arrived was what he wanted to wear 2 months later for Players Weekend. I was like, should I say that it's Big Fudge or not? But then I said, screw it. It's Players Weekend. We'll go for it. So I read the whole thing because there's just a lot more biographical information in there as well. Mm-hmm. Probably the deepest look into the Austin Davis story that we ever got, considering he just wasn't a very effective reliever for the Phillies. Like I said, he did debut for them on June 20th, 2018, in the thick of the Kapler era. And his debut was one of those ones, wasn't very high profile, but he got like a few sentences in the write-up with the Inquirer saying, a new reliever was introduced to the mix Wednesday when rookie left-hander Austin Davis made his major league debut with a score tied 3-3 in the top of the seventh. Davis surrendered a single, but then struck out Colton Wong before giving way to Edubre Ramos. It was really cool that Cap trusted me to come into that situation, and it worked out, Davis said. If Davis sticks around for a while, he'll discover that he can be used anytime and anywhere in Kapler's bullpen plan. He was then traded in August 2020 to the Pirates for a minor leaguer named Joel Caesar, who is in Redding currently with a 10.29 ERA through six games. And that's right. The Austin Davis story. And now we know a little more about him and a lot more about Grady Sizemore.
I have one question. Whatever happened to Players Weekend? I feel like the pandemic kind of put a stop to that and they just didn't do it again.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point. I mean, well, it was, didn't it hinge on the Little League World Series, which maybe they didn't have, did they do that in 2021 as well?
Maybe not. I don't know. But, I mean, there hasn't been any discussion of bringing it back, but we as fans should do that because it's fun. I mean, God forbid the players show any, you know, personality. I think recently, like within the last couple of years, they were allowed to wear, like, cleats in any color they wanted, maybe, or something like that. It's unclear, but, like, it just, God forbid any of them show their personalities. But knowing that so many of them are MAGA chuds, maybe it's better this way.
Yeah, I'm trying to find the... the first Players Weekend was 2017. They did have a Little League World Series last year. But I don't really remember... I feel like the last one was in 2019. And I'm reading a write-up on it on Wikipedia, and the last year they mention is 2019. So, I think you're right that the pandemic kind of threw that out of whack. So that is something that should come back because that's fun. That's a fun thing to do.
Yeah.
You know? And like the Little League Classic was fun, you know, just reminding people this is a kid's game and all that shit. That's always a good message to send out there. So, and letting players just like, you know, insert some of their personality into the game, even ones that don't typically play with a lot of, you know, notable personality. So, well, that'll do it for this episode of Continued Success. The Phillies are playing two games today, so we all get to look forward to that. As always, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and download all your favorite podcasts that are part of the Good Fight podcast family, including Hittin' Season with John Stolness, The Dirty Inning with myself and Dr. Trevor Strunk, and head on over to the Patreon at patreon.com/hittinseason. $5 a month, you can get access to Absolutely Hammered with me and Chris Jones, as well as monthly movie reviews with me and Liz, whatever content John Stolness puts up, and additional supplemental Dirty Inning content that Trevor and I also produce over there as well. For a measly $5 a month. Thank you for listening, and we will talk to you on the next Continued Success.